Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston and Andre Redatus. Hi, you guys.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey.
Good to hear you, Paula and Chuck.
Yeah, Marvin said he'll be listening in the background, perhaps, and maybe join in. If he can, you know, this is the season of family obligations, so, and it's a joyful thing, you know, obviously. We're all so overjoyed to be able to spend time with family and friends in the holiday season, so we may hear from Marvin today, not sure, but we're starting a new paper, which should be really interesting, paper 38, Ministering Spirits of the Local Universe. And, you know, it just follows in succession what we just studied, paper 37. But there's some amazing and wonderful sections in this paper. The origin of seraphim, angelic natures, unrevealed angels, the seraphic worlds, seraphic training, seraphic organization, cherubim and sanabim, and the evolution of cherubim and sanabim. Or sanabim, sorry. Sanafim. I'm tongue-tied today. And, of course, last but not least, the midway creatures. So this is going to be a wonderful paper. I'm really looking forward to studying it with you guys.
Yeah.
Why
Learn
do you
about
suppose
our angelic
that?
Friends.
Yeah. We humans, you know, I always marvel at the fact that, you know, an agnostic or even an atheist thinks that much of what a religionist believes is just fantasy, fairy tale, made up. And yet, so many humans on this planet are so deeply, keenly interested in angels. Mm. And billions are interested in Jesus. You know, and of course, you know, the concept of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a dilemma sometimes, you know. I know we all have such keen faith in the existence of our unseen friends. Trudy on the board said earlier, hello, dear friends, and hello to our unseen helpers as well, which is what, you know, here we are. We're going to talk about them now for the next few weeks or 6 weeks maybe. And how keen our faith is in their presence. And it's interesting. I mean, we're not the only ones. Clearly, this book explains their presence and their modus operandi better than anything I've ever found. But there's, like I said, billions of people who believe in their presence and honor them and remember them and pray to them and, you know, talk to them. We're either engaged in mass hysteria or they are real. and the more we invite them into our lives, the more they affirm our belief in the unseen realm. The more they minister to us, the more they show us their love and their mercy and their care. And that's been my experience, you know. I've just always felt them there, you know? And so the Urantia book was just a great, wonderful affirmation of their presence, a presence that I always felt. But what were you going to say, Chuck?
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, on a normal world, the existence of invisible celestial help would be common knowledge. You know, it would be this thing that people wonder about, either believe or disbelieve. Just, you know, just be known, because that's how things are. And as a planet, because of, you know, the things that have happened in the past, we've talked about, particularly the rebellion and how that disrupted the evolution of the planet and its normal course, that awareness has been largely lost. I mean, you know, there's mention of angels in the Bible, of course, and that's probably, I think in Islam, they have an idea about angels as well, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure, but I think so. But even so, those are all pre-modern, you know, scriptures, let's say, that take for what they have to offer. But in the modern context of scientific materialism, I felt to be particularly authoritative because it doesn't match up with purely materialistic view of things. And that's kind of what we're struggling with, is not only that in itself, but also what that has kind of erased from our awareness that would otherwise have been an ordinary, you know, knowledge about the way reality works.
But so even then, that knowledge, that ordinary knowledge would have been handed down by someone visible, right? Don't you think? I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But we've lost them. We've lost Adam
and Eve. But we've lost
the corporeal staff. We've lost so much.
The planetary
Those links.
Well, he's invisible. Those visible
things. People like to talk about aliens. You know? And there's this huge fascination about aliens. But in some ways, I think maybe just intuitively, there's an urge within that to rediscover celestial presence, which is kind of a different thing, but it both represent potential visitation from beyond this world that could bring great, great benefit. And of course, the celestial aspect of that does bring great benefit. I mean, just look at the Urantia book itself. We wouldn't have it without celestial help. So the Urantia book reawakens a new and much more credible understanding, I think, of this presence of celestial beings. You know, it's the way the Urantia book talks about that, the way they're described and explained, like this paper we're going to read today. It goes a long way. I mean, for me, reawakening this understanding, it's like humans are just part of the picture. You know, it's this whole other realm of being, personalities that we can't see at the moment, but we will be able to later, starting the next life. So it's kind of wonderful to have that included I mean, at least that's how I feel. Having that included in my reality frame. We're not just isolated on this rock, you know. I don't know. Struggling with a material existence. I mean, we are. We do often struggle with our material existence, but we're not alone, I guess, is the point. So we have help.
Yeah.
We have encouragement.
Right.
And there's also the shepherding of us into the next life, which is largely in the hands of these celestial helpers. So.
And inherent in all of that is this belief in this reality of the spirit, right? I mean, and the Urantia book has such clear teachings on the spirit, the reality of the spirit, being the greater reality, right? The greatest reality. And that material is just a time-space shadow of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such an intriguing statement to me. What do you think, what do you suppose they mean by that? The time-space shadow. Material reality is but the time-space shadow. If I can find that quote.
Mm-hmm. I think it really has to do with the substantial nature of spiritual reality. I think what they're trying to convey to us is when they say that to us it's the spiritual that is more real. It's not just that the spiritual is to them more real. To any personal being, including us, the spiritual is more real. If we really had contact with spirit, if we really understood what it was. And that's because spirit has to do with capturing qualities and quality in general. And the reality of spirit increases with the reality of the quality of that spirit. We get that clear indication when they talk about spiritual gravity and how that operates compared to, material gravity. And, you know, material gravity increases with the quantity of the mass of an object. And that makes sense to us. That's, we have quite familiar experience with that, and we've learned about it through physics and even utilized it most recently with our Artemis 1 launch around the moon and using the celestial mechanics, all the equations about physical gravity to navigate, and tomorrow we'll have that unmanned mission to the moon splash down. Well, with regard to spiritual values, we're told that as we increase in spiritual value, the sun's spiritual gravity more and more pulls us in. And it's got to be a very different kind of an experience than, you know, pure physical gravity, but it is effectively doing the same thing. We center in around that which is the value that we're attracted to, which is, you know, these higher values. The reason there is that spiritual gravity is the eternal sun is the absolute of spirit. There's no one that functions that way like the eternal sun. And so as we increase in value, as we become more spiritual, that gravity will have more and more of an effect on us. But they also indicate that to the extent that we are like, there's also a linear spiritual gravity that functions, just like the linear gravity among the planets and us, you know, being tied to the Earth. The linear gravity is such that like, not just like-minded people, but people of like values are attracted to each other.
Mm.
And I think this is best shown in terms of marital relationships that work. Mm. The best partnerships, the best marital relationships that work in my observation, are those where they share common values. Even if the common values are not the highest values, but if they're common values, I think that's the most important factor in getting that to function. It's not common culture. It's not common mind type, although that can be another significant factor. It really is values. If you have values incompatibility with somebody, it's very, very hard to make a relationship work.
Mm-hmm. That's so true.
Yeah. Well, values have a determining influence on decisions. So there's this flow of reality from spirit to mind to matter that they talk about a lot in the book. And I think maybe that's part of what's meant by that material things. I don't know if you found that quote, Paul, but being the shadow.
I found three, actually, that are really
good
and intense.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You want
one is from paper.
Yeah.
One is from paper one.
I think it has to do with the determinative role of values. Anyway, yeah, go for it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that values discussion is so important, too. I hate to sidetrack that. But
well,
this
you can
is,
go back to
it. Okay, this is from one paper 161. So early on, human personality is the, and you love this, Chuck, when they hyphen things, time space, hyphenated. Human personality is the time space image shadow. So that's hyphen two. Human personality is the time space image shadow cast by the divine creator personality. And no actuality can ever be adequately comprehended by an examination of its shadow. Shadow should be interpreted in terms of the true substance. Wow. And then in paper 56, which of course we know paper one is the universal father, right? Paper 56 is universal unity. It's interesting how the concept gets kicked up several notches here. This is 56.10.18. And again, hyphen time-space, Chuck. Physical matter is the time-space shadow of the paradise energy shining of the absolute deities. Truth meanings are the mortal intellect repercussions of the eternal word of deity, the time-space comprehension of supreme concepts. The goodness values of divinity are the merciful ministries of the spirit personalities of the universal, the eternal, and the infinite to the time-space finite creatures of the evolutionary spheres. Such a paradigm shift, such a perspective shift there in what matters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
the last one is from paper 189, which I can tell you also what that one is. That's the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
189.13. Mankind is slow to perceive that in all that is personal, matter is the skeleton of Marantia, and that both are the reflected shadow of enduring spirit reality. How long before you will regard time as the moving image of eternity and space as the fleeting shadow of paradise realities. You know, for me, this like that's classic Urantia book. In that just one of those statements you get lost in. You know, it's like, I try to fathom what they're saying. And, you know, maybe it's just me, but it's difficult to envision. And yet I know, I completely understand that spirit is the greatest reality. It is what motivates all that is even including material. It's the great motivation of all that is, the spirit of it. And God is the Spirit Father. And so much of our, you know, the way we anthropomorphize God in his big white beard sitting in his throne, you know. I love where the book says Jesus is the lens who makes, you know, in human likeness that makes visible to your creature eyes him who is invisible. Like we were talking earlier about the visible counterpart, our material counterparts on this world, who would have told us about the invisible realms and helped us to understand the reality of that. And we've had to figure out most of it on our own. But then comes this book that says things like what I just shared, you know, those three paragraphs, three different parts of the book where they're explaining physical matter as a time-space shadow.
There's one more in paper 12. Let's see, paper 12, 815, where they say that in cosmic matter becomes a philosophic shadow, cast by mind in the presence of spirit luminosity of divine enlightenment. But this does not invalidate the reality of matter energy. Mind, matter, and spirit are equally real, but they are not of equal value to personality in the attainment of divinity. Mm-hmm. Consciousness of divinity is a progressive spiritual experience.
Right.
So that kind of puts another twist on it.
And, you know, Andre, you mentioned spirit gravity. That is such an important concept that I have never seen anywhere outside of the Urantia book.
No.
And the way that I have expressed that to people that I'm introducing the Urantia book to, I like to key in on the fact that material gravity is in the process of taking our material bodies back to the earth. You know, which explains why when you get old, you start to bend over more and more. It's like gravity is winning the battle. You know, everything starts to kind of sag, and gravity is slowly but surely winning the battle over material. Material belongs to it, right? But spirit gravity pulls your spirit ever upward and inward toward the center of all things.
Go ahead. There's an attractive. We're attracted to higher values, whether they come to us from within through insight inspired by our adjuster, or we see them demonstrated by others. Whenever we see higher values, if we're honest and sincere in our desire to grow, we're attracted by higher values. And that's, I think, part of that gravity experience. And likewise with mind. You know, they also talk about mind gravity. So that, to me, has a lot to do with coherence. You know, they say the, you know, divine coherence is the quest of the ages or something like that. So when thoughts are presented that add coherence or bring coherence to our understanding, we're attracted to that as well. And I think there's something similar about values. You know, they provide value coherence, maybe, or the illumination of purpose.
Right.
I think that's part of why the spirit realities are the more real, because that's where purpose is originated. Or most
they're
clearly
enduring.
Understood.
They're more enduring.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like when someone moves on, everybody doesn't sit around and remember the material aspects of that person. What they remember.
Right.
Are the values, the spirit values of that person.
And the love, you know.
Yeah.
The love being one of them, being the primary
the
value.
Greatest, perhaps, the greatest of all is love.
Yeah, I've noticed that about memorial services. You know, they really do typically, I haven't been to a lot of them, but they almost always focus on what was best about that person.
Yeah.
And what everyone appreciated most about that person. Yeah, there's never a lot of talk about, remember that time when you know, the negative stuff is dropped.
He crashed his car.
You know, it's not so
he broke his leg or you know.
Whatever.
He always had a really great haircut.
Yeah, right. It's sort of parallel to adjuster memory, you know, that when we go to the next life, the adjuster retains all memories that have value, spiritual value, but a lot just falls away because it doesn't contribute to that. So I like to think of memorial services as kind of a foretaste of that.
I do too, because it really, it should serve to hone us in on what it is we value about each other and what it is we value in general.
Yeah.
You know, too bad we don't engage in that more often, you know.
Sure. And the book's
expressing
kind of
what it is we value.
Right, yeah. And I love how the Arantxa book kind of maps value, you know, starting with love and then almost like a white light going through a prism. Then we have truth, beauty, and goodness, you know, sort of the highest primary values. And when you hear truth, you know, you get that truth response. It's like, okay, I'm attracted to that. Or beauty. I mean, beauty is huge with that. And goodness, especially. You know, you see acts of goodness, or someone's being good, it's like, well, I want to hang out with that person, you know, just because it's so, goodness is so attractive. You know, it was that
I
way
think
with
that's
Jesus,
the key.
Too. Yeah,
right there,
yeah.
Chuck, you said, you know, gravity and attraction really go hand in hand. I mean, they could be even interchangeable in some respects, and it is. Ultimately, that's what it is. It's attraction.
Uh-huh.
It's what attracts you. And they give us those three primary values, truth, beauty, and goodness. And I've never met a reader who didn't really hone in on those, you know. As well.
Right.
And I've seen them reiterated now many, many times in common discourse, in, you know, especially spiritual discourse in general, not your Arantxa book, but I see those three values being mentioned often in spiritual conversations, truth, beauty, and goodness.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the Greeks. I think the Greeks figured that out.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to suggest that we jump into our reading.
Jump in.
We've got just two short sections: the introductory section and section one on the origin of seraphim. And we can come back to any of these ideas, but that'll help to focus our discussion.
Sure.
Who'd like to read those?
Do you want to go ahead, Andre?
Okay.
Read the first.
Okay.
Two. Yeah.
Sure. So, Ministering Spirits of the Local Universe, paper 38. There are three distinct orders of the personalities of the Infinite Spirit. The impetuous apostle understood this when he wrote respecting Jesus, who has gone to heaven and is on the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers being made subject to him. Angels are the ministering spirits of time. Authorities, the messenger hosts of space, powers, the higher personalities of the Infinite Spirit. As the Supernaphim in the central universe and the Seconaphim in a super universe, so the Seraphim with the associated Cherubim and Sanabim constitute the angelic core of a local universe. The Seraphim are all fairly uniform in design. From universe to universe, throughout all seven of the superuniverses, they show a minimum of variation. They are the most nearly standard of all spirit types of personal beings. Their various orders constitute the core of the skilled and common ministers of the local creations. And I might just state parenthetically here that the impetuous apostle is none other than Peter.
That was the impetuous. Well, of course he was the impetuous.
So they must be referring to something written in 1st or 2nd Peter. I'll look that up in a little bit. The other thing interesting, I'm in a group of Episcopalian men, and very often some of them like to pronounce cherubim as cherubim, you know, literally cherubim. Because of, you know, it is from the Hebrew, and so that would have been a Hebrew or Greek CH, and that would be, or in terms of its pronunciation. But in English, I think cherubim is just fine. So let me read on the next three paragraphs, and then we'll stop for discussion. Origin of seraphim. Seraphim are created by the universe, Mother Spirit, and have been projected in unit formation, 41,472 at a time, ever since the creation of the pattern angels and certain angelic archetypes in the early times of Nevadon. The Creator Son and the universe representation of the Infinite Spirit collaborate in the creation of a large number of suns and other universe personalities. Following the completion of this united effort, the sun engages in the creation of the material suns, the first of the sex creatures, while the universe Mother Spirit concurrently engages in her initial solitary effort at spirit reproduction. Thus begins the creation of the seraphic hosts of a local universe. These angelic orders are projected at the time of planning for the evolution of mortal will creatures. The creation of seraphim dates from the attainment of relative personality by the universe Mother Spirit, not as the later coordinate of the Master Sun, but as the early creative helper of the Creator Sun. Previous to this event, the seraphim on duty in Nevadon were temporarily loaned by a neighboring universe. Seraphim are still being periodically created. The universe of Nevadon is still in the making. The universe Mother Spirit never ceases creative activity in a growing and perfecting universe.
Wow. What a statement.
Yeah.
The creative spirit. They also call
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's
and the
those
reason they're relatively standard is that creative spirits are relatively standard. You know, whereas each creator son is completely unique, not only in personality, but in nature. On the other hand, all the creative spirits are essentially the same in a super universe. Hmm. The only thing that actually changes in a creative spirit is when she gets the stamp of her master spirit. I think that's at the time of the primary eruption, or that maybe that's the after phase. Mm-hmm. But when she's embraced by the master spirit, she takes on the nature of that master spirit. But other than that, they are all essentially identical, except, we're told, personality. And that's elusive as well, because personality doesn't seem to show up for creatures outside of the Mother Spirit. In terms of perceivable personality in her, until the time of the elevation of the Creator Son to universe sovereignty. And that's mysterious. But in any case, go ahead.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. The 41,472, I'll just make a comment on that.
I'm glad you did, because I was going to ask you about that.
Because the math geek in me loves it. And what that is, to those of you that want to know, that is 2 times 12 to the 4th power.
Wow.
In other words, 12 by 12 by 12 by 12 and 2 of each. You know, an aggressive and retiring would be the 2. Mm. And otherwise, there's a 12-fold kind of projection of nature on each of the seraphim. And they're trying to suggest something to us in terms of looking for that 12-fold pattern. It's suggested all through the Urantia book as a pattern that heavily influences mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Wow, thanks. I would never have known that. I'm so glad that you explain that, because I was going to ask you, what's the significance of that number? That's
amazing.
Well,
we'll see it show up later. Yeah, in a subsequent section. it becomes clear that that's what that is. So.
Hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. I hadn't noticed that either. Well, when you look at the unfolding of reality in the universe, you know, one of the patterns is going from 1 to 3 to 7, and we see that a lot. And then mm-hmm. there's also the decimal manifestations, you know, like we have 10 fingers
mm-hmm.
per
mm-hmm. right.
And there's usually symmetry of structure involved with tens. And
mm-hmm.
then here's the 12 thing. And
mm-hmm.
12 is a fascinating number. Well, I mean, there were 12 apostles. I don't know if that's relevant or not.
Right.
But you know, if you've ever done any carpentry, that's what's nice about inches and feet. You know, it's because you could divide it into fourths or thirds easily, which you can't
yes.
do with 10. Yeah, you know, dividing 10 into thirds
no,
is always,
you can't.
It's always a hassle if you're trying to measure wood or something for cutting. If you need a third of something.
Interesting, yeah.
Right.
So 12 has its own special relationship to things. And I don't know,
mm-hmm.
you could probably look into that, but I don't know if you have any thoughts about where else in reality 12 has a generative or a determining influence, but this is obviously one of them.
Aren't the basic personality types divided into 12s too, Andre? Different,
actually,
multiples of 12?
They refer to them as, when they refer to the types of psychic organization, that's where
mm-hmm.
12 comes in. And let me pull up that direct reference because it's, again, it's a fascinating one. It comes
mm-hmm.
in the Life Carrier paper that we read not too long ago. And it's right there. 36-16, where they're talking about world number 3 of the Life Carriers.
Mm.
It says, is devoted to the conservation of life. Here various modes of life protection and preservation are studied and plans for life conservation. It's all in this context. And then they say, on Urantia, there were 24 such custodian commissioners, 2 for each fundamental or parent pattern of the architectural organization of the life material. On planets such as yours, the highest form of life is reproduced by a life-carrying bundle which possesses 24 pattern units. And then parenthetically, and since the intellectual life grows out of and upon the foundation of the physical, there comes into existence the 4 and 20 basic orders of psychic organization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so that interesting thing, now they're saying that's based on the physical. So what does that have to do with, why would seraphim be produced that way? Well, they are creatures of the creative mother spirit. And the creative mother spirit, we have to remember, while she is called the creative mother spirit, what is she mainly in charge of? She's in charge of the same thing that her originator is in charge of, mind. The infinite spirit is in charge of mind and mind gravity and absolute mind. The creative mother spirit is in charge of all mind that arises in a local universe, that is at least creature mind. And that
mm-hmm.
would go from all the way from Gabriel down to us, and even below us, even the animals, even
mm-hmm.
down to first adjuvant mind of the most primitive animal species, like amoebas and that kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff. So
yeah.
it
mm-hmm.
seems that vegetation is excluded from that, but even they are said to have that physical kind of mind, the mechanical mind that is sponsored by the physical controllers. So anyway,
mm-hmm.
fascinating stuff about all of that.
Yeah, well, if you look up a few paragraphs to paragraph 11 in that same section, they kind of break
okay.
this down in a little more detail. I could just read that really quick. Here they say that the number 10, this is 36211. They say the number 10, the decimal system, is inherent in the physical universe, but not in the spiritual.
Mm.
The domain of life is characterized by 3, 7, and 12, or by multiples and combinations of these basic numbers. There are three primal and essentially different life plans after the order of the three paradise sources and centers. And in the universe of Nebadon, these three basic forms of life are segregated on three different types of planets. There were originally 12 distinct and divine concepts of transmissible life. This number 12, with its subdivisions and multiples, runs throughout all basic life patterns of all seven super universes. There are also seven architectural types of life design, fundamental arrangements of the reproducing configurations of living matter. The Orbiton life patterns are configured as 12 inheritance carriers. The differing orders of will creatures are configured as 12, 24, 48, 96, 192, 384, and 768. On Urantia, there are 48 units of pattern control, trait determiners in the sex cells of human reproduction.
Now,
wow.
And that, just as an aside, is an interesting and controversial statement because, you know, it was already known, or it wasn't quite known yet at that time in the 30s, but very, very soon thereafter, I forget exactly whether it was in the 40s or 50s, you know, they learned that there were 23 pairs of chromosomes or 46 chromosomes. And so in people looking at this, they said, well, wait a minute. Isn't the Urantia book getting it wrong? And, you know, I know even as a young reader, I looked at that and I said, huh, why are they saying 48 here? And we know that there's 46 chromosomes. And then you look at it again and you say, on Urantia, there are 48 units of pattern control, trait determiners in the sex cells of human reproduction. They never say chromosomes. They never say that that's the exclusive kind of trait determiner. Oh, there may be another pair of trait determiners that are non-chromosomal. Interesting. So just an aside there for those who have ever looked at that as a potential inconsistency in the Urantia book. Remember, they never refer to those units of pattern control as chromosomes. They refer to them as trait determiners, and that's more generic.
I wonder if epigenetics could have something to do with this.
You have to wonder at this point, now that we're making those kinds of discoveries.
That's a much more recent discovery. They used to refer to that as junk DNA. Remember that?
Yeah.
And then they figured out, oops, maybe this isn't junk after all.
It's not junk after all.
It's actually a layer of protection for the underlying genetics. And
which proves the adage that God doesn't make junk.
Yeah.
There you go.
He don't make no junk.
But epigenetics have a trait determining effect or influence.
Yeah.
Which is kind of overlaid on top of the underlying genetics. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what also occurs to me about the Spirit's ministry too is that, you know, we are so heavily dominated in this way by 12 and by multiples of 12, and they minister to us, you know, the finite creatures of time, space. So, you know, they're in a way so akin to us, and they minister so closely to us and with us in the spiritual sense. So they and I found it also interesting that you know, we learned in the last paper what the sun does, and they even mention it here, his unique creation, the material sons and daughters and sex creatures. Now mm-hmm. they're telling us about the mother's creation, her angels.
Yeah.
And I love that they reiterate that this hierarchy, again, you know, in the first sentence, or I think it's in the first paragraph, where they talk about supernaphim, siconaphim, and seraphim. So in that hierarchy of angels,
mm-hmm.
they often reiterate that pattern, those patterns, the accelerating and evolving universes.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Oh, and regarding our mother spirit, a comment I just wanted to throw in a minute ago is that, just to reiterate, that she's a third source personality, unlike us, mm-hmm. unlike Michael. You know, we're first source personalities. And that in her case, at least, her personality emerges over time. I mean, she's always been personal to Michael, but in these stages of local universe development, her personality emerges. And then fully, finally, after the Jubilee of Jubilees, when Michael completed his seventh bestowal. Mm-hmm. And that's
she becomes more recognizable, right, to us.
They say she becomes recognizable to all contacting yeah. personalities, which would include us. But before that, she was it's not as easy to I don't know.
Discern,
yeah, it's a good word for it. But she's different. You know, she's all kinds of differences associated with, you know, complemental differences to Michael. You know, like Michael, his personal presence is always located somewhere in one place, right? He can't be in two places at once, whereas she's everywhere, the way they describe it. Her presence permeates her entire creation. So that's, again, a very complemental difference. And then the way they relate to space and time, too, of course, as we've read about before. You know, that Michael can transcend time and she transcends space. And together, that complemental difference, when they work together, that creates a symmetry and a completion of possibilities that would not be possible to either one individually. So we get this master pattern of super additive outcomes that result from complemental relationship, which comes all the way down to even the human experience of gender, you know, the difference between men and women. That complemental difference produces super additive outcomes that would not be possible otherwise.
Mm.
So all of that, I don't know, it's fascinating.
It's fascinating to realize that even at that level, our mother, our creative mother is evolving. Our universe sovereign is evolving, mm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the Jubilee of Jubilees is a milestone in their evolution, just like we have milestones in our mm-hmm. human lives, right, where we graduate and get a degree or get married or whatever, you know, these milestones we mark, becoming a man or a woman, you know, they have these evolutionary milestones. And that's just one such is celebrated in the Jubilee of Jubilees. Huge one, right?
Yeah, that was a big one.
It's a big one.
Because Michael completed his achievement, supremacy or supreme sovereignty in the local universe. So as his consort, it elevated her as well in this significant
right.
way. And they made those joint pronouncements and everything about, okay, this is a new state of affairs here.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful.
A new
to read
chapter
about
begins.
That.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. A new chapter in our universe evolution begins. And it affects mm-hmm. every single being in this entire universe. Every single one.
Yeah.
All of us.
This second paragraph in part one is interesting. The first sentence there, they say, these angelic orders are projected at the time of planning for the evolution of mortal will creatures. The creation of seraphim dates from the attainment of relative personality by the universe mother spirit, not as the later coordinate of the master son, but as the early creative helper of the creator son. So they're making a distinction there with, first of all, with Michael, between a master son and a creator son. I mean, he's still a creator son, mm-hmm. but now he's also a master son. So at that, what we were just talking about, the Jubilees, he becomes a master son. But they're saying mm-hmm. that before that, the creation of seraphim dates from the attainment of relative personality. So that would be at the time when they declare their intention to create life, I think. And that's mm-hmm. what you're describing, Andre, with the master spirit. The master spirit of the super universe goes into some kind of a deity embrace or something and comes out, and there's this huge mm-hmm. flash, you know, that can be seen all the way to Uversa. And at
eruption,
that point,
primary eruption.
Yeah,
that's what they call
quite
it.
A flash.
Empowered to create life.
Yeah.
Quite
yeah.
a flash.
Right, exactly. It must have been. Well, it shows how important the creation of life is. The capacity, having been born in her or transferred to her in some sense from the infinite spirit through the master spirit, at that point her personality emerged relatively compared to what it was before, but not yet completely emerged. So that, you know, from the date of relative personality, so that would be the, I think they're describing that stage of her development where she's now mm-hmm. able to create life. And that would not just mean material life, but also creating seraphim, apparently. I mean, they're alive, obviously. So somehow that creation of those living beings, they're not physical organisms, mm-hmm. but they're living beings and they're alive. So that would be part of that, I think, is what they're saying. The creation mm-hmm. of seraphim dates from the attainment of relative personality. So anyway.
Well, Andre found the biblical quote of the, how did they term Peter? The impetuous apostle.
Peter, basically. Yeah.
You want to read that, Andre?
Apostle, yeah. Sure. I put in a little bit more for context,
mm-hmm.
just as to, you know, they're really talking about the nature of Christ and following Christ and all of that. And then these last four verses sort of come together as a sentence. After being made alive, he went and made proclamation to the imprisoned spirits. To those who were disobedient long ago, when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. Now, this is all Peter's opinion, right? Or
mm-hmm.
what was captured of it. And it only...
Where are you reading
in
from?
It, I'm reading from 1 Peter 3:19 through 22.
Oh, great.
It's in the chat as well for those of you that are looking in the chat. God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. And this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you also. Not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a clear conscience toward God. So there's an interesting reference to baptism,
mm-hmm.
hearkening back to Noah. Interesting. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And here's the quote, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. You know, sometimes I marvel. Someone I was talking to was trying to read the Bible. We were having a Urantia discussion and we were reading the book, the Urantia book, and then we switched over to the Bible. And I marvel at how difficult it really is to read the Bible, in that I don't know, you know, it's just, it's hard. It doesn't seem to flow, and it takes a certain cadence, and people who have practiced for years can really do it well, but it isn't easy. I have never found it easy, which has been maybe a personal
challenge
for me.
Yeah, I never did either. You know, when I got to, you know, I tried to do it as a youth. I forget how old I was when I was trying to go through the Old Testament, and I figured, well, what would it be like to read this from the beginning? And it might have been after Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments came out. Wasn't he in the Commandments? Somebody
yeah.
was in the Ten
yeah,
Commandments.
He was
anyway.
Moses.
Yeah, okay. So when that came out, you know, I thought I would try. And my God, I think I got stalled at the Begats and
oh, I did,
you know, all
for
those,
sure.
All those names. And it was like, really? You know, it just was not, you know, if there were like those children's toys, square and star pegs and round pegs and whatever, these pegs were not going into that hole. The different, you know, when I ran across the Urantia book, it was a completely different experience. It was like
completely different.
Oh, all those holes. These are the right pegs. They go right in. Wow.
It's kind of like you're so thirsty. You know, for me, the analogy is I was so thirsty by the time I found the Urantia book. And and any experience I'd had with other traditional scriptures was like a shot glass full of water compared to a well, you know. And just, you know, you could just take a dipper of as much as you could drink, you know, and just satisfy your thirst. Whereas the Bible was like the shot glass effect. So, like, you said, well, okay, but, you know, I want to get to the real stuff. When do we get to the real meat of the matter? You know, it was just not satisfying. And no disrespect to biblical scholars. I know they've learned it. They understand it. They know it. And they can make it come alive for people. And they can find the meaning and the value. But I just have never found that it was easy. And particularly gratifying to my hunger and my thirst. And so, you know, but the Urantia book has been a feast and a well.
Yeah. Well, it's much more coherent.
Yeah.
Which is why I think
it's
such a pleasure to read. You know, the Bible tends to switch gears right in the middle of the passage or a chapter. You know, it's like, wait, you're talking about, now it's talking about this, what? You know, there's this kind of discontinuities that make it really hard. But you're probably familiar with this, but there's an interesting comment in the book about the Old Testament. Maybe I just read this really quick. It's the first paragraph in the section about sacred and profane history, 97:8-1, where they say, the custom of looking upon the record of the experiences of the Hebrews as sacred history and upon the transactions of the rest of the world as profane history is responsible for much of the confusion existing in the human mind as to the interpretation of history. And this difficulty arises because there is no secular history of the Jews. After the priests of the Babylonian exile had prepared their new record of God's supposedly miraculous dealings with the Hebrews, the sacred history of Israel is portrayed in the Old Testament. They carefully and completely destroyed the existing records of Hebrew affairs, the doings of the kings of Israel and the doings of the kings of Judah, together with several other more or less accurate records of Hebrew history. So all of that was destroyed, which is such a shame to think about. It's kind of like with Melchizedek.
It is, all in the nature of crafting a particular narrative. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's what we're looking at when we try to read the Old Testament. I mean, not all of it, but large parts of it. And that's probably why it doesn't. It's hard to get a sense of coherence about it because coherence was sort of destroyed in order to serve this other purpose.
Yeah, there's another quote that's relevant there too. It's from paper 55. It's Jesus saying, you know, it's 155:6-7. He says, "I admonish you to give up the practice of always quoting the prophets of old and praising the heroes of Israel, and instead aspire to become living prophets of the Most High and spiritual heroes of the coming kingdom. To honor the God-knowing leaders of the past may indeed be worthwhile, but why, in so doing, should you sacrifice the supreme experience of human existence, finding God for yourselves and knowing Him in your own souls?"
Hmm. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, that's a great one.
First-hand religion. I think they've been comment about that. Paper 195, I think. You know, we need more first-hand religion, which I think is what Jesus is talking about there. You know, the feeling of the reality of these things that arises within each of us, you know, individually and originally. And that's where we can really have something to offer in the present time. And the problem if you think about it, all the scriptures of all the major world religions, they're all pre-modern. You know, they go way back. So they don't benefit from the more, I'd say, post-modern, understanding of basic, scientific realities and things like that. And that's what's so delightful about the Urantia book is it does utilize and bring into its narratives, this understanding that's been evolved, in recent times. So that makes it all very much more credible and comprehensible and relevant also.
I appreciate any effort that people make to make it more, to make it flow better. And, as Bob on the board pointed out, it's arcane, and that's what makes it difficult. But I appreciate, the New American Standard version that makes it, more readable. And I've always wondered why they break each statement up into so many different little choppy paragraphs that, that's another thing I never could figure out why, they had to do that. But it must have something to do with the fact that it was handed down long before we had any way of printing it or sharing it with each other. And, who knows why they had to do what they did. I'm grateful that they did whatever they did because it is the foundation of our understanding about God and angels and Jesus and, on and on. So, take nothing away from it. Only that I guess I'm a creature of my own time, and it was very difficult for me, which explains why I think, in part, why they felt like we were ready to have something more, something that was going to take us into the future now. And they gave us the Urantia book. And why a book?
Yeah.
Because we can return to it time and time again. We can study it. We can know it. We can ask questions of it, and it answers our questions. It's there. It stands. It will stand the test of time. And the fact that they give us back our history, to the quote you read, Chuck, it's invaluable.
Yeah.
The things that they tell us in the history of Urantia are absolutely invaluable. How we came to be who we are, our systems, our various systems of government and spirituality, religion, everything.
Well, the other thing that's fascinating to discover in the Bible is that the in terms of the Old Testament, is that it's the older parts that have the higher concepts of God. And we can understand that from the Urantia Books perspective, thinking about the Sethite priests and the Salem missionaries. And that kind of explains why, you know, like in Psalms, some of those go way back. It was some more recent stuff, you know, that was cooked up, you know, starting around 600 BC, where you get all this, you know, massacre all the neighboring tribes, and it's, you know, highly nationalistic and cruel concept of God is more recent.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's the older, parts, you know, like Proverbs and Psalms in particular, that have a much higher concept of God. So you wonder, well, how, it seems counter to evolution, you know, as you think the newer ones would be better, but the older ones are actually the better ones. And we can understand that from, you know, now that we have the Urantia Book, because we can tell us about the sources of those older teachings coming from the efforts of the Sethite priests and the Salem missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting to have that perspective. And then you can begin to see how they're really two different God concepts in the Old Testament. That also makes it very confusing. There's the God concepts of the older teachings and then the prophets, and then there's the concepts of the, you know, the priesthood who are trying to suppress those other, you know, they killed most of their prophets, right? But thankfully, some of their teaching is still in there. But, you know, there's always this conflict going on between the priests and the prophets, you know, kind of thing. And there's vestiges of both. And because they're so contradictory, it makes it very confusing. Like, who's this God they're talking about? It sounds like there's two different gods. How could that be, right?
Yeah. Well, the one that Jesus represented is certainly different from
he's a fulfillment of the oldest teachings and of some of the prophets. He's not a fulfillment of
right.
the more recent, you know, sort of corruption teachings.
That's true.
Of the priesthood. So that's something that most Christians don't understand. You know, they try to reconcile these two different concepts of God that are found in the Old Testament, trying to make them into one. And it's just like, oh, love your neighbor, but meanwhile, go out and massacre your neighbor. You know, it's like, how do you resolve that?
Right, right.
It just doesn't work, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I want to read some of the comments on the board, too, because they're very good. Perry made this comment. She said, original thinking and spiritual inspiration is not even as highly regarded in UB circles. The book is often the authority. And Pam said, yes, Christian restructionism has long influenced the hold that biblical authority has on traditional church to this day. It's insipid. And also something to note, how it affects every aspect of our culture. And, you know, so those are important concepts. I agree that we aren't always, you know, Pam admonishes us not to make a fetish out of the Urantia Book. And I agree that we shouldn't do that and that we should honor what Jesus was saying, the original thinking about God and to allow each other to come to God in an original way. In an inner way, based on our own spiritual experiences, which is what Jesus was saying in that discourse on true religion or on religion, and you know, so there's pitfalls there. It's interesting, you know. I've met a lot of people over the years that have different understandings of all of these matters, and in fact, everybody has their own unique understanding. Their own unique point of view, as he points out in that discourse. And we can't be aligned in that point of view because we're all looking from an absolutely unique place, our own inner life and our own collection of experiences, which are unique.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, it also...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and it also, I think, speaks to the nature of revelation. I mean, the purpose of revelation is to reveal. It's to reveal
right.
reality that you wouldn't be able to discover otherwise. I mean, particularly the higher revelations, even in, you know, in the Urantia Book in particular, they're revealing to us the existence and the nature and existence of reality. So we wouldn't be able to discover on our own. But the point is to engage with those realities. The revelation opens our understanding and makes it possible for the mind to explore into the possibility of those realities. And then, you know, what follows from that is an individual and unique experience of those realities. And that's what's really the important takeaway or outcome from the study of revelation. It's not the word formulas or turning statements into dogma, but using the revelatory power of those statements to actually discover reality, existing reality that we can engage with in a living, dynamic kind of way. So
good point. And it unifies our understanding, at least, you know. We may have different experiences.
The intellectual consistency and of the Urantia book and all of that is wonderful. And, I would never want to take anything away from that.
It's invaluable.
But I guess it becomes a fetish if you forget that we're being invited to engage with reality, not just with the text.
Well, yeah. And just another authoritative way, to lord it over something or somebody, you know. But it's not that. It's a jumping off place. And that place that we can jump off from leads to so many other great revelations, and those revelations come from the inner life.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Which
well, that's one thing
invaluable.
I love about studying the Urantia book, particularly with other people, because you get these new insights, you know, you get these cross-references. Like, you know, Andre's already brought in a couple that were, like, really cool, you know, and that expands our...
you do that
you know,
all the time.
Yeah, we do that all the time. And particularly once you become more familiar with the book, then you begin to, you get this sort of more like a three-dimensional or a four-dimensional or five-dimensional, I don't know, you know, this new kind of engagement where the reality frame is familiar, but then there's so much to understand within that, and to be able to cross-reference from different parts of the book really expands that sort of understanding. But
I think the angels delight
say,
in that, actually.
What's that?
You know, speaking of the angels, I think they delight in that. I think they delight in our relationships and our abilities to share and explore with each other and exponentially create more value in each other's lives. Just through that sharing, you know.
Well, I'm being mind ministers, among other things.
Yeah. So what a joy. Go ahead, Andre.
No, I wasn't going to say anything particular. I agree with what you guys were talking about, this idea of there's such richness in the text when you consider all the other parts of the text that relate to it. You know, that's some of the, I can speak to this a little bit because I have some familiarity with it, but in the Center for Unity's project on the Jesus Metaverse and putting that together, that's some of what is interesting about the project is the idea of connecting up one part of just even part four with all the different relationships and events and different things. It's a fascinating way to look at part four again, you know, to be able to do eventually a study on anything that you want to look up by essentially going and saying, I'd like to know something about Jesus' relationship with Matthew or whatever, or I'd like to know something about, you know, Mary Magdalene's work in the women's corps. Or whatever it happens to be, and just being able to approach that. And, you know, you can do that with the entire Urantia book. And it goes across parts as well. There's any number of things in part one that relate to things in part two, three, or four, and vice versa. And I think the authors have constructed it that way so that,
yeah,
you know, rather than trying to be – deliberate and literal, which would encourage a kind of literal kind of study. They instead have augmented the text by, in 2,097 pages, they realized they had to put a limit on how big it could be, or you would have fewer and fewer people reading it, right?
Right.
There would be fewer people reading a 3,000-page book than there are reading a 2,000-page book. And we have even, you know, difficulty getting people to read the whole book that way. But in so putting it together that way, they also constructed it so that it would reference things from other parts that those two pieces of information would synergize to create a new realization that they didn't have to necessarily state directly, but that a study would reveal. So
yeah.
I mean, that's an important feature of your Urantia book. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, sometimes I think of the Urantia book almost as like it's a book of clues. and it's to put the clues together. So that creates a dynamic engagement.
It's like that number, 41,472.
Yeah,
there's a clue. You know it.
Yeah, right. I almost think that the authors must have anticipated the emergence of search engines when they were putting this book together.
Oh, they had to have. They had to have anticipated the internet. They had to have. They knew it was coming. You know, it wasn't that far out for them. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, how far can they see when they look forward? How far do they see? They who have had experience with millions of inhabited evolving worlds, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not that unique. We're unique.
Yeah.
But we're not that unique. And, you know, all of these problems are human problems, and they get solved, I think, pretty much the same way. And as the universe looks at the problems of an evolving world, that's what they see, patterns, you know, of growth that happens on all worlds, an evolution that happens on all worlds. It's like we can look at children and say, well, this is what they should be doing at one, this is what they'll probably be doing at two, and at three they'll be doing this, and at four... And we've got it down to a whole science by age, how children grow and how they evolve and what they can accomplish. I think we're no different to our universe supervisors. They know us precisely. Mm-hmm. They could almost predict to the nth degree what we're going to come upon next. Mm-hmm. And
interesting example of that, you know, at the house here, we have John Hayes library. we have like all these old books and all kinds of stuff that sort of got parked over here. And amongst within his library are these documents that were produced in the early days, you know, going back to probably the late 50s, maybe early 60s, where Sadler and others would do topical studies on the Urantia book. And they would laboriously find these passages and hand type them into these massive documents, you know, they're topical studies. So they pull references from different parts of the book and try to get them all organized together in one place and then type it all up, you know, on typewriters with mimeograph or whatever. And the labor of love that went into some of these studies. It's just remarkable. I mean, it's not,
hence
it doesn't
the well-thumbed
have any
book.
Yeah.
The book
right,
with all
exactly.
the tabs and the well-thumbed book, yeah.
But now, you know, just with the search engine, we can kind of get to the same place very quickly. So those don't really have any continuing purpose. But they are evidence of tremendous effort to, you know, begin the kind of work we're doing even now on this radio show. Of cross-correlating and seeing the connections and coming with this more greater spatial, almost kind of understanding the teachings and how they relate to each other.
To see the patterns, the threads that go throughout the whole book. I mean, it's invaluable.
Exactly. So what you're saying,
we're blessed.
Childhood development is kind of apropos, I think. You know, looking over the history of this process of human engagement with your anthropology, how it began and how it's now evolved to where it is, and who knows, you know, the metaverse thing. I don't know. I mean, there's no telling.
I find it comforting.
We're still at the very beginning. We're still very early on. I mean, I think we always have to remember that.
Right.
Who knows, you know, what the future holds.
Who knows where it'll go. But I find it comforting to know when I imagine how they view us, and it's one of my favorite things to do, is to try to see our world through their eyes, you know, to try to look at the problems they faced in bringing this to us, or the problems, the challenges they face in helping us get to the next evolutionary level. And I just, that insight is comforting to me, to realize that we're in good hands, that they know exactly where we are, where we're headed. They probably know very well the pitfalls we'll face. They also know we'll overcome them. We'll be able to overcome them. You know, what we'll achieve. And when and how and what it'll take, what discoveries we need to make, prerequisite to other discoveries, which are essential. You know, when they say that they can't give us unearned knowledge, I appreciate that. When they say it'll rob us of the discoveries of the next 1,000 years, I really appreciate that, because there's something so special in the joy of discovery. You know, it's like discovering the Urantia book. That was one of the most joyful things that's ever happened to me. And, you know, so I really appreciate their wisdom, and I'm comforted to know that the universe is friendly and well-ordered, and that our disorganized and chaotic planet is in good hands, ultimately, and we will reach that wonderful goal of light and life, the goal that they lay out before us. And they express every confidence that we will reach it. You know, it's never, there's never doom and gloom in the Urantia book, right? Never.
Well, there are stern warnings.
There's stern warnings, true.
Yeah, and they do tell us about the Lucifer Rebellion and the presence on our planet of these.
And that's gloomy, for sure.
Well, I don't know if I call it gloomy exactly, but there are dangers. They're trying to alert us to the fact that there could be dangers ahead.
Well, yes,
and
absolutely.
Be,
and what,
you know,
loving parent wouldn't
why
do that?
Why is the serpents, you know, that whole thing.
Right.
And, you know, not to just think we're going to be floating off on a cloud, you know.
Right,
you know,
no.
We got to
evolution is slow, but
on.
It works well.
Yeah.
But there are dangers that could set us back, right? And that's always the key that they kind of give us, that this could set you back. This could set you way back. So try to avoid this, you know. and we, I know we all perk up when we hear those warnings. We go, wow, you know, they're making a pretty stern warning right here. But even that is done with love and assurance. They could step in if they had to. They don't want to. They want us to figure it out, I guess, and that's comforting to me. Just like you want your child, you know, most fathers are this way, and I love this about fathers. They're not so protective. They're not such helicopters as mothers are. If a kid falls down, you know, they fall down. They're going to get hurt sometimes. That's just the way life is, you know. It's very comforting to me, that attitude in fathers, because it's reassuring that you can do it. That you can survive these cuts and bruises, and they'll heal, and you'll be okay. You know, it's a transcendence kind of a thing, and I really prize that. And that's something that fathers, I think, uniquely hold.
There are plenty of mothers these days that are doing that as well. I think there's been a crossover that has been happening where
it's true.
There are men that can become more nurturing, and there are women that, for lack of a better term, can let go a little bit more and not hover so much. But I don't think
and
it's
not
ever
hover
been,
so much, right?
Yeah, that hard and fast. you know, maybe in a bygone day there were more stereotypic roles, but I don't see much of that in modern parents today as much. I see people actually trying to get, you know, their bearings from the science of parenting. That's what
I agree.
I see millennials and Gen Z people, you know, studying, trying to see what's suggested. And not necessarily from books. It could be online. It could be any number of things.
And
I'm just
certainly
wondering,
the science of child psychology helps. Yeah, we're going off down a rabbit hole, and I'm sorry.
Yeah,
are we meandering a little? Does that ever happen?
We're meandering a little.
I don't know.
But shall we
read another section?
Yeah, let's do. I'd love to. Okay, so.
Would you like to read it?
Do you feel like reading, Paula?
Sure, I'll read it. It's section 2, Angelic Natures. Angels do not have material bodies, but they are definite and discrete beings. They are of spirit nature and origin. Though invisible to mortals, they perceive you as you are in the flesh without the aid of transformers or translators. They intellectually understand the mode of mortal life, and they share all of man's non-sensuous emotions and sentiments. They appreciate and greatly enjoy your efforts in music, art, and real humor. They are fully cognizant of your moral struggles and spiritual difficulties. They love human beings, and only good can result from your efforts to understand and love them. Though seraphim are very affectionate and sympathetic beings, they are not sex emotion creatures. They are much as you will be on the mansion worlds, where you will, quote, neither marry nor be given in marriage, but will be as the angels of heaven, end quote. For all who, quote, shall be accounted worthy to attain the mansion worlds, neither marry nor are given in marriage, neither do they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels, end quote. Nevertheless, in dealing with sex creatures, it is our custom to speak of those beings of more direct descent from the Father and the Son as the sons of God, while referring to the children of the Spirit as the daughters of God. Angels are, therefore, commonly designated by feminine pronouns on the sex planets. The seraphim are so created as to function on both spiritual and literal levels. There are few phases of Marantia or spirit activity which are not open to their ministrations. While in personal status, angels are not so far removed from human beings. In certain functional performances, seraphim far transcend them. They possess many powers far beyond human comprehension. For example, you have been told that, quote, the very hairs of your head are numbered, end quote. And it is true, they are. But a seraphim does not spend her time counting them and keeping the number corrected up to date. Angels possess inherent and automatic, that is, automatic as far as you could perceive, powers of knowing such things. You would truly regard a seraphim as a mathematical prodigy. Therefore, numerous duties, which would be tremendous tasks for mortals, are performed with exceeding ease by seraphim. Angels are superior to you in spiritual status, but they are not your judges or accusers. No matter what your faults, quote, the angels, although greater in power and might, bring no accusation against you, end quote. Angels do not sit in judgment on mankind. Neither should individual mortals prejudge their fellow creatures. You do well to love them, but you should not adore them. Angels are not objects of worship. The great seraphim, Loyalatia, when your seer, quote, fell down to worship before the feet of the angel, end quote, said, quote, see that you do it not. I am a fellow servant with you and with your races, who are all enjoined to worship God, end quote. In nature and personality, endowment, the seraphim are just a trifle ahead of mortal races in the scale of creature existence. Indeed, when you are delivered from the flesh, you become very much like them. On the mansion worlds, you will begin to appreciate the seraphim. On the constellation spheres, to enjoy them. While on Salvinkin, they will share their places of rest and worship with you. Throughout the whole Marantia and subsequent spirit ascent, your fraternity with the seraphim will be ideal. Your companionship will be superb. What a beautiful section. I really love that one. That's like the definitive, don't you think? That's a really definitive section on angels and their nature.
Mm.
And who they are.
Indeed.
Yeah, agree.
What do you think they mean? What do you think they mean when they say the seraphim are so created as to function on both spiritual and literal levels? What do you think they mean by literal?
Yeah, I think they mean relating to the material level. They
kind of what
actually can interact.
Huh.
Yeah, not necessarily regularly, but we're told that it actually was an angel of the Lord that helped, you know, release Peter from prison at one point,
that it wasn't
a midwayer.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all of that.
Yeah,
all of that's
curious.
Kind of,
I mean, they could have said spiritual and material, spiritual and physical, but instead they used the word literal. Just wondering if there's maybe a little more to that. I'm not sure, but.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, it's just another way. That's the way I understood it in context, Andre, you know, while reading.
Yeah.
They're speaking about, you know, they're kind of in between the spirit realms and us, and so they have influence over both.
Mm. Well, literal, I'm thinking like the root in there. I'd have to look it up, but, you know, we think about literature. We think about stories being related to literature.
Right.
You think of what's written down
in that sense. You know, so you're thinking of something that is recorded, and
they are literally
interacting with our level of reality and recording it with us.
Uh-huh.
They're recording our lives. That makes
a
difference.
And along with that is just the story of our lives. You know, they minister to the within the story of our lives, in a way, and of course they do record all of that, which is preserving that story. So I don't know. I'm kind of getting a little.
Well, how valuable
from the word literal?
How valuable that story is
to
the universe, to them, to everything.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, just a thought.
Well, they just say so much in this section, like, you know, they enjoy all of your non-sensuous, they share, not enjoy, I shouldn't say enjoy, but they share all of man's non-sensuous emotions and sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
And they appreciate greatly and greatly enjoy our efforts in music, art, and real humor. So, you know, I appreciate that. To me, it's like, you know, the little kid brings his drawing up to mommy and she puts it on the fridge.
Right.
She doesn't do an art critique, you know. She just says, yeah, it's lovely, honey, and puts it up on the fridge, you know.
Yeah.
As in, so that those are our efforts, right? Our efforts in music,
mm-hmm,
art, and real humor. And how grand it would,
yeah,
be to appreciate their efforts in those matters, you know.
Well, then
for
they
us
go
to
on
be able to really
that,
appreciate.
Yeah. Well, they go on to say that they're fully cognizant of our moral struggles and spiritual difficulties. And if you take that line and combine it with what they say later on about how they don't sit in judgment, they're not our judges or accusers. There's something comforting about that. That they have.
It's very comforting.
They're fully cognizant of our moral struggles and spiritual difficulties, but yet they do not. They're not our judges or accusers. So that's the combining those two together, I think, is an interesting, it's way more than interesting. the feeling of companionship, you know, and then later on they talk about how their companionship will be superb. And I think knowing us during this life is what's going to, it's going to contribute greatly to our later companionship with them when we, you know, can actually see them and interact in a more or less direct way.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that they know the whole history of our first life. They know the story of our initial existence here on this physical world. And they can bring that in, I'm sure, in many cases with great humor, you know, and affection. And all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Bring
it into true perspective.
I always get a good feeling when I read this section.
Me too.
There's something wonderful about the nature of ministry coming from the
Again, we're in good
center.
Hands. You know, and
yeah,
by now,
yeah,
if you've read from paper one and you get to this section and you realize just how good, what good hands we're in, you realize how highly competent they are, how well trained they are, how well experienced they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that they're, I don't get that they're terribly surprised by what we might do. And, you know, to your point about judging, I immediately think about the angel that gives her her summation of a human life.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Right.
You know, such a life on such a planet, the wonderful, that we all love to quote that last line of that section. But talk about how they understand our moral struggles, right? She goes into depth about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And really explains what the difficulties were. And especially in a world like this, you know,
mm-hmm,
I often... the idea that they share our emotions touches me because there have been times in my life when I felt like I grieved with them. And, you know, I think often we think that spiritual beings don't feel grief, but I think they do. They get over it more quickly.
And then they also experience the whole range of positive feelings as well.
Of what, Chuck?
Of positive feelings.
Oh, of positive feelings, yeah.
Yeah, joyful feelings.
Joyful
share
feelings.
Share those too. Yeah.
Laughter.
The whole gamut from grief to joy.
Imagine how like they share worship with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When we decide to worship, imagine how joyful that must be for them if they can worship with us. I had an experience. I went to see, you guys know our good friend Larry Geis. I went to see him in the gay men's choir in San Francisco, and they were practicing their Christmas concert. This was, in the late 90s, and this was their dress rehearsal. And he said, you guys will love to come and see that. Norman Ingram was with us. We had been there working in Expo, and he said, I'm sure you guys will love to come down and watch the choir do their dress rehearsal for our Christmas concert at St. Mary's. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we went down to do it. And I was sitting there watching the choir, and Norman Ingram was wandering around the periphery, looking at the various stations of the cross and the art and different things in the sanctuary. But I so love choral music, and I was just rapt by the gorgeous tones they were achieving. Oh my gosh, the harmony they were achieving was splendid. And the last carol they sang, I'm not familiar with it even to this day, but I just know that they built and built and built to this crescendo that was incredible. And the note they hit was exquisite. The harmonic that they hit was, oh. And I had my eyes closed as I was listening to this. And the moment I opened my eyes, I saw angels all around them. And when they hit that note, the angels threw up their arms into the air like, here you go, Father. This one's for you. It's like they gave it to him. They gave that beautiful harmonic that they were singing with that choir. That's what I felt. And just for that moment, I saw them like a beautiful diadem around this, you know, like a crown of light around this choir, this chorus, the gay men's chorus. Wow.
Well, what a lovely depiction.
I will never forget that. Whenever we reach a harmonic, whenever we sing beautifully, Glenn and I went to see Celtic Woman on Monday night, last Monday, playing with the symphony orchestra. And they sing like angels, if you ask me. But the same thing, when they meet, they reach a harmony that is just sublime. And that experience taught me that the angels experience that with us. They join us in that, in our efforts. They join in them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our efforts at music and harmony and worship, they love that, I think. They celebrate that with us.
Yeah, well, that kind of goes along with this interesting quote, you know, it's like, see that you do it not. I am a fellow servant with you and
with
your races. We are all enjoined to worship God.
Yeah.
So that speaks to a quality of relationship that, again, is kind of more like a companionship relationship. Even though they're ministering to us, they're also our companions. And that'll be much more clear in the next life, of course. But just setting the, you know, making it clear. It's like, no, don't worship me. Let's worship God together, right?
You're right.
We're like coworkers, kind of.
Yeah. I'm a servant with you. Yeah.
Right, yeah. See that you do it not.
Let's join together and all worship God.
Yeah.
And it's important. Isn't that important when you're worshiping to think about that? To think about now we are worshiping and they are worshiping with us. And, yeah, I love thinking about that. And I love thinking about how when we come together as many times as we have over all these years, they come together with us and they enjoy each other's company. They probably compare notes.
I'm sure it's very convivial.
Yeah, very convivial. Absolutely.
Interesting that they named this particular seraphim. I just checked, and that name only appears once in the book. But the great
Loyalation.
Servant. You pronounced it very well, Paula. I would have struggled with that. Loyalation, I guess. Interesting that she's given, you know, her name is given in this context. I don't know if that's in the Bible.
That's the only place it appears, Sancha.
In the Urantia book, yeah. I just did a search.
What paragraph is that? Which paragraph does that show up in? In 5?
It's what we just read.
There
it
is. Right.
Yeah,
you do well to love them, but you should not adore them. No, it was the great seraphim Loyalation. When your seer fell down to worship before the feet of the angel. So that had to have been a human. She had to have been here on the Ninja, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was
that
John in Revelation.
That was John in Revelation.
Referring to Revelation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I can get the quote. I looked that up just recently.
Interesting.
Would you say that all of there's several quotes in this section? They're all biblical, wouldn't you say?
More than likely.
More than likely. Yeah.
But that one particularly is actually out of Revelation. See that you do it not.
She said that to John.
But they don't name the seraphim there.
Or they don't
do
name
here.
John in the Urantia book either, which is interesting.
Well, they don't.
They call
don't
him the great seer.
They're trying not to over-honor our earthly compatriots because of our tendency to over-honor them. They don't want us to start saying, well, they mention John in the Urantia book, but they don't mention, you know, so-and-so. So just pay attention to everything that John says and ignore the rest or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't want to take anything away from us, and they don't want to skew our perception. Yeah.
I'll find that for you. I'm curious, because I wonder if it can take from this that maybe Loyal Asia had something to do with John's revelation. That maybe the seraphim was communicating the revelation to John in some way.
Right, even though we're told that a lot of it, you know,
I'm talking about the original
and distorted
original version.
Yeah,
the experience. Yeah, wouldn't you love to see what it was before it got garbled? And
I know the Secretary of Midwares have a copy, so I'm hoping and praying and petitioning.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, to see looking forward to seeing some of the stories about what Jesus did on that year that they don't tell us about, too. You know, I mean, it's interesting. What was that year like? And you've told us every other year.
Which
Why
year
not
was
that one?
Which year was that?
Oh, it's like right before he begins his public ministry, I think, or during that time when there's one whole year that they don't tell you anything about.
Huh. Never noticed that.
Yeah, I can't remember now exactly where that shows up, but it's in that area.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, this section, you know, I also keyed in on this idea of marriage. And, of course, what occurred to me, too, when they said, let's see. Nevertheless, in dealing with sex creatures, it is our custom to speak of those beings of more direct descent from the Father and the Son as the sons of God, while referring to the children of the Spirit as the daughters of God. Angels are therefore commonly designated by feminine pronouns on sex planets. So that's something they do on other planets, wouldn't you say? This is a common way throughout the universe, and maybe the universe of universes, that they designate the sons of God and the angels as the daughters of God. Do you understand it to mean that? Or I don't understand that they're saying on just this planet they do that.
Just try to repeat your point. I'm perhaps missing what you're trying to get at.
This is common throughout the universe that they designate it this way. Not just
you mean feminine pronouns?
Yeah.
Seems pretty clear.
The sons.
Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you know, we kind of get hung up on that. But that's interesting. That's a common way that's a common method they use on all worlds. on all sex planets, on the sex planets. And I was also interested, they go on about marriage. I guess because there are certain religious sects that teach that marriage goes on in the mansion world or on beyond this life. But they're pretty clear about that in here. You'll neither marry nor be given in marriage, but will be as the angels of heaven.
Mm. Yeah.
But that doesn't rule out special relationships.
No, of course not. But because they're all special, right? Isn't that the point? I mean,
but I mean, even special gender. You know, they say that the difference that we call male and female will persist and continue all the way through our entire ascension. So I assume even on the mansion worlds, even though we won't be reproducing beings, there will still be this natural attraction that will draw us together, you know, male and female.
Right.
And in other words, we don't become androgynous on the mansion worlds all of a sudden.
You know? Oh, no,
And the angels, and the angels aren't either. And the angels aren't either. They also have complementary difference. So.
Right.
Not, in other words, not to take anything away from that, but obviously we're not going to marry for the purpose of offspring.
Right. And Jesus said that in other ways too, saying there will be no free or bond, male or female. You know, those designations. We're all the children of God. Mm-hmm. One big family.
Yeah. Well, and in this life, you know, we struggle a lot with our natural physical urges. I'm sure we're all aware. And it'll maybe be kind of nice to be free of that, even though it can also bring great pleasure, even on this world, and bring about, you know, wonderful relationships when it works out right. But, you know, so much, I don't know. You know, like you think about celibate priesthoods and all of that, you know, just all the kind of maybe misadaptations to what, you know, the interaction refers to, the powerful sex urge, you know, can create all kinds of suffering and
can wreak havoc.
Yeah, definitely. So in the next life, maybe part of what they're saying is that that will fall away. You know, we'll no longer be whatever distracted by that exactly. But nonetheless, maybe the attraction between, you know, our continuing existence as male and female, there'll still be an attraction there. And there'll still be an urge to co-create on other levels. I'm sure it'll be great affection and everything else. But it won't have that.
You kind of refer to that as a liaison, right?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting terms.
Yeah, one of the terms they use. Yeah.
Liaison.
So the relationships are a blessing, but they're not dominated by physical urges. That's interesting.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
But there still could be this emotional and personal attraction and all kinds of things and great affection. All those dimensions of relationship will still be there. But not that kind of driving physical part of it. Anyway, interesting to think about that.
It's cool, I think, to wax philosophical about what it's like. When you take that out of the equation, what you're left with is the essence of a relationship. Excuse me. The things that really make it so, so beautiful and eternal. That's just one aspect, and it's temporal. But there's so many other more enduring qualities of relationship that go on. And we get to discover all of those and enjoy all of them. like our unseen friends are doing right now. It was a great conversation on the board how we probably keep them laughing and greatly amused by our human antics and
face palming too once in a while.
I think I'm sure we do.
Don't do that.
We're bona fide characters.
Right. Exactly.
You know, probably the yeah. reward for being on this difficult planet for them is some of the some of the goofy things we come up with to keep ourselves entertained. You know,
yeah,
I'm sure they they get a kick out of us on many levels, just like we get a kick out of a 2-year-old. You know, that's the way I look at it. They enjoy us the way we enjoy precious little children, and what sin would we lay on at their feet, you know? I don't think we would. And I don't think they don't judge us. Yeah.
Yeah. Reservoir of forgiveness. And, you know, the mercy credits they talk about. And the evangelists are very much involved with administering our mercy credits.
Right. And reflecting our real nature back to the universe to show them who we really are, in spite of all of our difficulties on this most difficult planet.
Right, They can have us be in touch with who we really want to be, you know, our deeper longings.
Our heart.
Longings. And, right.
Our true sentiments. Well, wow. What a great conversation. What a love, what a wonderful thing to talk about, angels. You can't go wrong.
Yeah. I found the Revelation quote, by the way, and that's
you did?
Revelation 19:10. And I'll put it up in the chat.
Okay.
But that's the one with and the it was,
and I fell, and I fell at his feet to worship him. But he said to me, "See that you do not do that. I am your fellow servant and of your brethren who have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy." That's the quote from where that's taken.
Interesting.
And that's from Revelation.
That's from Revelation 19:10. Yeah.
19:10.
Well, it's interesting when they give us these little snippets of the original version of Revelation, this one short quote, and how it's different from what we have recorded. There's a couple other places where that shows up, which can give us a little bit of a perspective on how it was modified.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it is. What version of the Bible is that from, Andre? Is that from King James?
Well, I picked it from New King James, that particular one.
Oh,
Would you like a different version?
No, I'm just, it's significantly, it's different in some significant ways. That's why I asked. The one they gave us makes a lot more sense, right? But doesn't mention Jesus or the testimony of Jesus, which, you know, I find very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See that you do it not. I am a fellow servant with you and with your races who are all enjoined to worship God. It's so succinct, you know? But maybe the biblical, maybe the authors of the Bible threw in that testimony of Jesus right there. I don't know. Who knows? It's interesting. Well, anyway, you guys, thank you so much. It was a wonderful study. I sure appreciate it. Great way to launch our study into the ministering spirits of the local universe. Thanks, all of our friends on the board. I love reading your comments every week. Look forward to seeing you. It's always so good to see you. Gina, Pam, Bob, Trudy, Perry, love you so much. Thanks for coming. And I love to see you, John and Vaughn, on the call, listening in. So good to see you here. We appreciate you. We appreciate all of you in, out there listening to the archive. We'll be back next week with section 3, and it's a short section, Unrevealed Angels, but then it goes into 4, the Seraphic World. So that'll be a good section. And Seraphic Training is up on section 5. So things to look forward to.
The Unrevealed Angels, it's interesting to consider just because they're really trying to expand our point of view and say, there's more we're not telling you than we're telling you.
Right.
Yeah.
So with that, that'll be the last
thanks
word.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Andre and Chuck.
Bob.
Great, Daddy.
Trudy. And Vaughn, everybody on the board. Very nice to have you. And until next time, bye for now.
Bye for now.
Yeah. Have a great week.
Love you guys.
You too.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.